How does God work with His people? How does He go about taking us who are rebellious, stubborn, disobedient people, and cause us to be people who will respond to Him, who will love righteousness, who will pursue holiness, who will be able to love the God we disobeyed? How could that happen? Exactly how does God work with and train His people? And what is that exact relationship God establishes with those whom He has chosen? Psalm 73 helps us understand some of those questions. And that's the psalm we'll be studying this morning as we continue through the summer in the study of Psalms. Let's turn to number 73. We'll read it and then we'll look at it together. Psalm 73. Surely God is good to Israel, to those who are pure in heart. But as for me, my feet almost slipped. I had nearly lost my foothold, for I envied the arrogant when I saw the prosperity of the wicked. They have no struggles. Their bodies are healthy and strong. They are free from the burdens common to men. They are not plagued by human ills. Therefore, pride is their necklace. They clothe themselves with violence. From their callous hearts comes iniquity. The evil conceits of their minds know no limits. They scoff and speak with malice. In their arrogance, they threaten oppression. Their mouths lay claim to heaven, and their tongues take possession of the earth. Therefore, their people turn to them and drink up waters in abundance. And they say, "How can God know? Does the Most High have knowledge?" This is what the wicked are like. Always carefree, they increase in wealth. Surely in vain have I kept my heart pure. In vain have I washed my hands in innocence. All day long I have been plagued. I have been punished every morning. If I had said, "I will speak thus," I would have betrayed this generation of your children. When I tried to understand all this, it was oppressive to me till I entered the sanctuary of God. Then I understood their destiny. Surely you placed them on slippery ground. You cast them down to ruin. How suddenly are they destroyed, completely swept away by terror. As a dream when one awakes, so when you arise, O Lord, you will despise them as fantasies. When my heart was grieved and my spirit embittered, I was senseless and ignorant. I was a brute beast before you. Nevertheless, I am always with you. You hold me by my right hand. You guide me with your counsel, and afterward you will take me into glory. Whom have I in heaven but you? And being with you, I desire nothing on earth. My flesh and my heart may fail, but God is the strength of my heart, my portion forever. Those who are far from you will perish. You destroy all who are unfaithful to you. But as for me, it is good to be near God. I have made the Sovereign Lord my refuge, and I will tell of all your deeds. Now we're going to begin by talking about the terrible predicament of Asaph, who wrote this psalm, and then we'll get into the solution on your outline there as we see how our gracious God takes care of this terrible problem. And Asaph begins by reviewing for us his keen disappointment in life. And he's just laying his heart open. And he's sharing honestly how he feels. And the interpretive context of this, again, is the fact that this is God's man. If we're talking about it today, we'd say, this is a Christian who is writing this. This is a believer. This is coming from a man who knows God. and a man whom God has worked with and made his own. This is one of God's elect, one of God's chosen. And yet here he is in this terrible dilemma, in a terrible problem. We say, how can this happen to God's people? Well, it does. And one of the tragedies of our day, in the presentation of the gospel, people are told that if they come to Jesus, then everything will be all right from there on. There'll be no more problems, no more difficulty. That is false. A Christian is no more exempt from difficulties of life than anybody else. And Asaph is talking about that. He's disappointed in what's happening to him and those around him. He looks out there and he sees the wicked prospering. He talks about that. They're wealthy. They get along fine. And the righteous suffer. And you and I see that. We live in a neighborhood. Here's a Christian family and they have all kinds of trouble. And across the street is a wicked, godless group of people and they seem to get along fine. Their business prospers. Never seem to have tragedy and trouble. Living carefree. This is what Asaph is talking about. This is reality. We live in this world. It's a depraved world. It's a corrupt society. And we have to face our life here. And Asaph says, I became envious. And then I began to doubt. And this doubt led to despair. And he said, I got on the very edge of things. I almost went over. As for me, my feet had almost slipped. I nearly lost my foothold. Christian talking about this. He talks about the description of the wicked, how arrogant they are. Their prosperity, no struggles. They have good health, free from burdens, filled with pride. And they become violent and get away with it. Their hearts are hard. They're full of iniquity. They scoff. And then they play God. They act as if they're running this universe and they've got control of the world and all that's happening. And then he gets into the results and say, in verse 11, then people say, does God know about this? Does God really dig what's going on? Does God understand what's happening here? That's what they're saying. Where is God? He doesn't know what's happening. And Asaph is saying, in vain I've tried to live for God. I've tried to live in innocence. And what's the use? Why not just give up. Give in to it all. Why be a Christian after all if it's all this tough and we're going to suffer and they get along swell? Why should I try to live in purity? And in a sense, Asaph gets very close to sharp accusations against God to say, God is failing. This can't be right. The world gets along so great and Christians struggle. God's not doing it right. And if he's doing it right, he's too slow about it. He needs to speed things up and take care of me right now. Well, this is Asaph's problem. And it's so real for all of us. We come now to the gracious work of God. To see how God works in his life and how he delivers him from these kind of attitudes as he at the very edge of things. And he's crumbling in doubt and self-pity. We might say he quit going to church. He quit exposing himself to the means of grace that God had provided. And he's in a desperate condition. And we begin now on your outline to look at the redeeming grace of God in verse 23. Where Asaph uses the word which could be translated nevertheless or yet, as he says, in spite of all of this, yet I am always with you. You hold me by my right hand. Nevertheless makes all the difference. There's the transition. In spite of all this terrible trouble and disappointment, I'm still with God. And God is with me. That's the grace of God. That's the redeeming grace of God in working with His people. Now, one of the reasons we can say that this is a believer talking, this is the context of a Christian, is that an unbeliever never gets that far. An unbeliever could never make this statement about the troubles and then to say, yet I'm with God and God is with me. The nevertheless here is a connection that makes all the difference. And he states the fact that God is with him and I am with God. And we see the patient, redeeming grace of God. Life is still here because God keeps the Christian life going. Truth prevails, and He sees the truth. God redeems His chosen. And Asaph realizes that after all of this, he's still forgiven, he's still with God, and in spite of it all, nevertheless, God is still working in my life. He's still committed to me. Now, it's not because Asaph is good, not because his behavior and his performance has been great. It's been terrible, really. He's not responding well at this point. What's God going to do with him? Is He going to write him off and cast him out and say, Asaph, you're not worth working with? No. The faithful, redeeming grace of God is here. And he brings Asaph to the realization of the truth. I'm still with you. And this is grace. Now, the second thing we see here is the restraining grace of God in verse 23, where he says, yet I am always with you, and you hold me by my right hand. Now, this is how God works with us as a Christian, as a believer, as one of His chosen. God holds us when we are going down. God holds us when we doubt. God held him. He said, as for me, my feet had almost slipped. I was losing my foothold. Why didn't he? Because of the faithful, restraining grace of God in the life of His people. God held him. He was at a point of despair, but why didn't he fall? Because of God. He's in God's hand. The restraining grace of God holds us up in trouble, and it holds us back from further sin. We live our life as a believer in this world, we sin. We don't perform perfectly. What holds us back from being worse? God's restraining grace. He holds us by our hand. He keeps us from being worse. Think about that in your life. What has kept you from falling into worse sin than you've committed as a Christian? What keeps you from following and falling into further temptation? Why, it's the restraining grace of God. Think of how God has restrained us and held us back and held us in check to keep things from being worse. You think about anything in your life this morning, and it could be worse. It really could be. Why isn't it? Because of God's restraining grace, helping us in temptation, keeping us from plunging further into sin and deeper into trouble. It's happened to all of us. And even while we are unbelievers, God keeps a restraining check on His chosen and directs our life. When I was in the army in the Philippines, I was presented with an opportunity to make a fortune through dealing with stolen goods in the black market. I didn't do it. Why? Because I have greater moral honesty than the other men who wanted to do that? No. Not a bit better. Could have done it from a human viewpoint. Very appealing. Would have set me up financially for life. Or in prison. Maybe I was too scared. Thank God I get scared. No, you look back and you say, God did that. You can look at your choice and say, I decided. But what made you decide? God does that. God's restraining grace. God is working. He holds us up and He holds us back. The third thing we see here in God's grace is the restoring grace of God. He brought Asaph back into focus. He said, I didn't understand things till I entered the sanctuary of God. Then I began to understand. And in the restoring grace of God, He brings back our senses. Our spiritual senses are put in the right focus. We begin to have the right perspective on life. We can see spiritual and eternal values again. And one thing that God shows him very clearly and he understands is the very definite problem he's facing about the wicked and their prosperity and all that's going to happen. And he says, they're getting along great and we suffer, there's no justice. And then God shows him perfect justice. I didn't understand till I entered the sanctuary of God. Then I understood their final destiny. Surely you've placed them on slippery ground. You cast them down to ruin. How suddenly they are destroyed, completely swept away by terror. God's justice will prevail. We need to know that as a believer this morning. We can look around, we can feel like Asaph. God will take care of it. He opens his eyes to see that. And he understands that God is going to destroy and punish the wicked. As you read through these Psalms, you'll see that at several places we read that God is angry with the wicked every day and that His wrath is upon them. Now that's the evangelistic message. That's what needs to be proclaimed today. We put people to sleep by walking up to say, God loves you. Well, I'm okay then. No, you're not okay. You are in desperate condition. You are facing right now an eternal hell. And you're going to be destroyed eternally. And you desperately need the grace of God. Bow before Him in mercy and call upon His grace. Asaph understood that. That I understand now. And it's all right. Now he went into the sanctuary of God. Could be interpreted into the presence of God. But I think there's something more specific here that he actually went to worship probably with God's people. And in that kind of environment, he sensed the presence of God. Now, interesting thing here, Asaph didn't even comment on the sermon. Maybe we ought to talk to him about that someday. He wasn't very impressed. Didn't mention the choir. But he talks about the presence of God. Isn't that wonderful? He met God. And that's the restoring grace of God, the presence of God. Now, what made Asaph decide, we'll say, to go to church or go into the sanctuary of God? Well, you could say it's his marvelous decision. He was smart enough to do that. Or he had some high spiritual thing going. No, he didn't. God made him decide that. And God's will is more powerful than your will and my will, and He directs. And if He didn't, none of us would be here. The reason we are here this morning to worship is that God has inclined our heart to do so. And He put us here. It's grace. We're talking this morning about our gracious God. His redeeming, restraining, restoring grace. It's all the way. For by grace are you saved through faith, and that not of yourselves. It's the gift of God. Now that doesn't change once you become a believer. God doesn't save you by His grace and then say, okay, now you're on your own to live as a Christian. No, it's all by grace. Redeeming, restraining, restoring grace. You don't become a Christian one way and then live the Christian life another way. God doesn't save you by grace and then you live by works or by your performance or by your ability to keep the law. It's all of grace. God's in it all the way. Not only in salvation, but in sanctification. And He is committed to that this morning. And that's the marvelous grace of God. Another kind of grace here we see is the persevering grace of God in verse 24. God's grace perseveres, as Asaph writes in verse 24, "You guide me with your counsel, and afterward you will take me into glory." Now, trying to read into Asaph's thinking, we could say, well, all right, Lord, I really thank you for your redeeming grace, your restraining grace, your restoring me here. I thank you for the understanding you've given me and the new sense of the realization of your presence and your commitment to me. But now what about the future? How am I going to do tomorrow? How am I ever going to make it through this life and afterward wind up in heaven? How's that going to happen? What if I slip again? Well, here's the persevering grace of God. You guide me with your counsel, and afterward you will take me into glory. And the truth here is that God is going to persevere in the lives of everyone whom He has chosen. Not one will miss heaven. And not one will go into heaven without being sanctified and being a part of the perfect bride of Christ. There'll be no second-class people in heaven. God prepares us for that moment. That's what He's doing. He will take us to glory because God will persevere. Now, sometimes this is doctrinally called eternal security. That's a good word. It is sometimes called the perseverance of the saints. And that's confusing. Because it is not, first of all, the saints who persevere. It is God who perseveres. And the saints respond to Him in perseverance. we will not lose our faith. God preserves that for us. Now, I don't know anything that could bring more assurance to our hearts today. Greater hope as we live in this world of difficulty, greater comfort and greater joy and peace and motivation to live the Christian life and to sense God's empowerment to do so, to live for Christ and pursue righteousness in a wicked world without fear, not for works, but because of God's persevering grace. He does that. He's committed to that. God's people are always brought back. We talk about backsliding. Or the Christian who's not really doing great at the moment. What does God do with them? He only lets them go so far. He's restraining. He'll restore him. He'll bring him back, and God will persevere. Do we bend out? Yes. God brings us back in persevering grace. Now, I don't know anything that could be so comforting for parents, for Christian parents. And here, a parent's work 15, 16, 17 years or whatever, and a young person is out there. Now, it's when you're about the third grade, you're out there. I mean, you know everything now by the third grade. The third graders are doing now everything we started to do in high school. So it's kind of changing a little bit. You can't go by me though, because my dad said to me one day, "Son, it's time you went on to higher education." And so I entered high school. I was 21. But we face that. The world's there. Some Christian young people are going to bend out. What's God going to do? He's going to hold them. He's going to bring them back. That's a marvelous thing. I give them eternal life and they shall never perish or be destroyed. Doesn't mean they'll perform perfectly, but they're still in God's hands. And all of this is based on God's eternal commitment to His chosen. Another kind of grace we read here is glorifying grace. Asaph states it in that same verse, "You guide me with your counsel, and afterward you take me into glory." Verse 24, glorifying grace. You're going to take me into glory. You shall bring me into glory. Now, we get some of that now. When by faith we appropriate the riches of God's grace, we get in on that right now. And every believer can understand something of the glory of God, because God produces the fruit of the Spirit in our life now. And we get to see glimpses of that in Scripture. One day we will have the fullness of glory, and you will be a glorious person. Forever, for all eternity. And that's God's business now, to bring us there. And we have some realization of it, but God's purpose in eternity is to have a glorified people. He's committed to that, and He's going to get you there. And because you know that, you respond to Him this morning, to serve Him and worship Him and love Him, and that's the most powerful motivation you'll ever have. If you won't do it out of gratitude for God's grace, you'll never do it any other way. This is it. And Asaph is realizing that. A glorified people with the complete removal of sin. The complete removal of selfishness. The complete healing of relationships. As we are made into the image of Christ. That's what God is doing for His people. That's the way He works in our life now. It's certain. It's guaranteed. It's an absolute because of God's grace. Redeeming, restraining, restoring, persevering, and glorifying us. Well, how do we respond? What do we say to this? In verse 25, we have the ultimate response. This is what we should say this morning. What does Asaph say? Whom have I in heaven but you? And there was no one on earth I desire but you. Because of these great truths of God's grace, he gives himself to the worship and adoration of God. That's a response. And we talk about heaven and people get into all kinds of things that talking about streets of gold and gates of pearl and other people that are going to be there and what it's like and how many harps they'll have or whatever. We even get the wrong idea about heaven. The reason to want to be in heaven is to be with God. He is the supreme, not things and not others. Asaph is saying here, now, Lord, you mean more to me than anything or anyone. I worship you. More than anything else or anyone in heaven or on this earth, I worship you. It's God himself and God only. And I will no longer be guilty of idolatry because you're first. This is the highest. This is the ultimate response. Other places in the Bible, we read about the desire for God as a hunger and a thirst. In Psalm 46 or 42, he talks about the deer that goes down by the stream and is panting for a drink of water. He says, that's the way my heart longs for God, God only. We need that. Asaph is saying, God is enough. When you know the grace of God and you respond to Him in this way, that's enough. And even when my flesh fails, God is the strength of my heart and my portion forever, in verse 26. My flesh and my heart may fail, but God is the strength of my heart and my portion forever. God's enough. That's sufficient. He's adequate. And we need to learn this lesson this morning because we look everywhere else. We may say, yes, I'm Christian, but I'll tell you this. I think we're full of idolatry. And I think I am. We let other things crowd out. Everything Asaph is saying here, whom have I in heaven but you, and being with you, that I desire nothing on earth. That's true, but we don't get there very often because we let some good things get in the way. We let Christian ministry become more important than God Himself. Isn't that amazing how we can let good things get in the way? We can let preaching sermons be more important than God. Or any kind of Christian ministry. We can let witnessing or evangelism or missions or discipleship take the place of God. Asaph learned not to do that. Whom have I in heaven but you? And I think I know some people who even worship prayer. And some people who even worship worship. A style of worship. how subtle that is. And how we slip into that. And people worship spiritual gifts. Or miracles. Or a building. You just go on and on with it. Check it out in your life. We can allow career, vocation, profession to get in the middle here between God and our life. Whom have I in heaven but you? And whom do I desire on earth but you? And certainly we let the material things of life do that to us. The love of more possessions. Just after the Olympic program last night, on the same channel, there came on a program, and I don't know the name of it, but they began to interview Tony Orlando. Now, I guess before I go on here, does anybody know Tony Orlando? Am I communicating? Okay. I don't know much about Tony, but he became a very, very popular recording artist, had his own TV show and everything, lived it up, had all the money a young man could ever possibly hope to have. And he had to quit. Something lacking. He said, it didn't do it. It didn't do it. The pursuit of all this stardom and the people raving about him and all the money he had didn't do it. He quit. And he said, and he has a son. And he showed scenes of him playing baseball with his son. He says to the interviewer, you know what counts in life? He says, a picnic. Going for a swim. Hitting a baseball. Just said some great things there that brought it back into perspective. Now, he didn't get into the Lord or anything, but he was bringing great message there. None of these things we're talking about in the Christian life, whether ministry or service or whatever, they're not enough. And if we pursue those only, we fall short and we fail, we get tired and we quit. They're very wearing. The only refreshing thing is the presence of God. We need the presence of God in our midst. And if people come to church here, we don't need them to comment on anything but this. They met God. Might be a lousy sermon. Could have been hot and muggy. But I met God. God is with us. We let pleasure come before God. We let seeking comfort be the big thing. Recreation. We let other people become more important than God. And even when we go to church, people will say, or you ask a person, where do you go to church? And they'll say, oh, I go to hear so-and-so. The exaltation of people, too much. Or people will say, I found this group. I don't hear much of, I met God, and He means more to me than anything else. We need that. We need to respond to God's grace this morning to say, Lord, I worship You. I adore You with all my heart. You have my life. Allow nothing to become an idol. We need Him. He is adequate. He is in control. And He will bring us through. We need to worship Him as the God who He really is. The sovereign God. I have made the sovereign Lord my refuge. and I will tell of all your deeds. This morning, we're going to worship in some singing in response to God. Be wonderful if we could follow the example of Asaph, to worship Him only.